Gregory Pardlow won the Pulitzer Prize in 2015 for his poetry collection, Digest. In his new book, he turns to prose, interweaving memory with family history and reflections on being black in America. It's called Air Traffic, a memoir of ambition and manhood in America. And Gregory Pardlow joins us now from NPR's studios in New York to talk about the book. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks a lot, Eric. It's great to be here.
Let's start with the title, Air Traffic. Your father was a member of PATCO, the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Organization, in the late 70s up until 1981. For most of us, you know, our jobs and our sense of self are wrapped together a bit, and that seemed to be the case with your father. Being an air traffic controller, it was an intense job, you know, really shaped him and in some ways how he raised you, yes?
Absolutely, and I think probably all the more intense because as an air traffic controller, the only job that you're trained for and qualified to do is to sit in that tower. There aren't many transferable skills. So his identity was very much wrapped up in being on that microphone, speaking to the airplanes and conducting things in the air, which he brought home with him, that sense of ego, domination. I think there's a little more than your garden variety masculinity going on in that identity.
Right. And he became a local union leader and he was, you know, a charismatic public speaker. He kind of became the voice of the local union. And as you write, he loved to be the center of attention. He had this sense, you know, of sort of your family's exceptionalism.
Well, it was more his own exceptionalism, which he then extended to his wife and his kids, who were pretty much, to his mind, extensions of himself. A lot of his motivation in life, I think, was sort of rooted in the tensions he had with his father, which then get played out in his relationships to institutions, his relationships to community, his relationships, as I say, to his family, his wife and kids.
Let's get a better sense of your dad. He's a big part of this book. I mean, he would give you these challenges. I mean, you're right. It was kind of like the bridge keeper in Monty Python. He'd ask sometimes random or intense questions or, you know, to define words. Can I have you read that section? Maybe just set it up real quick and then read that.
It was a punishment that he, well, that was the context that he gave me this exercise in. But the outcome was that I actually gained a love for language and a love for discovering new words and words that are just sort of outside of my vocabulary. My father devised punishments that were cunning and proud. He dropped the family dictionary like a Christmas ham on my rickety desk and gave me, with no more to go on than the mere attire of its pronunciation, an unfamiliar word. Disconsolate, for example. He would enunciate the word with the monotone of a spelling bee announcer. I had to find the definition of the word and then find, in that definition, another word I did not understand. I was then to look up that subsequent word and so on until I could prove to my father's satisfaction that I understood every word in the definition clearly, verifying the lexical descent from my original word, at which point he might or might not assign me a new word.
So he'd give you these forms of punishment, but you'd end up understanding new and different words all the time.
And I think that some of that was my resistance to him punishing me, right? So if he was going to impose this on me as a punishment, I was going to, and I'm admitting to having the chip on my shoulder now, I was going to turn that around and make it useful for me, enjoy it, actually. It made a huge impact on my imagination, my sense of my relationship to the language, and the way I related to my father through language.
Poetry, in the end, kind of saves you, and you owe some of that to your dad.
I even bristle now. You know, as a middle-aged man, my father's been gone for a couple of years, and I still bristle.
The shadow looms large.
The shadow looms large, absolutely. Right. But yeah, of course, that's absolutely true, yeah.
Then came what you call the defining moment in your dad's life when the Air Traffic Controllers Union decided to go on strike in 1981. President Ronald Reagan ordered everyone back to work within 48 hours or be fired. And Reagan ended up firing more than 11,000 PATCO workers and banning them from federal employment for life. And your father was one of them. He was suddenly without this job that had been such a big part of his life, had been a big part of the middle-class family you guys had built. that firing ended up sort of shaping a lot of your childhood.
It was a pivotal moment in my own life. I mean, I was 12 years old when I remember walking the picket line with him, and people were throwing food at us from cars on the highway and honking and shouting, you know, profanities at us as they went by. And it was really disillusioning. It was really, if not just confusing to me, because I was so certain of the righteousness of what we were doing.
Your dad struggles to bounce back. He eventually does. And you yourself seem to struggle to find your place in the world. I mean, you dropped out of college twice. You try the Marine Corps. That doesn't work out either. You total your new car and the debt ends up sort of following you around. And, you know, and yet you do keep bouncing back. And you may bristle at this, but, you know, part of that resilience perhaps came from your dad and him bouncing back from the Paco strike?
It did. Yeah, it absolutely did. Now, and this is the double-edged sword, or, you know, whatever metaphor I want to use, double-edged coin.
That'll
or
work.
Two-sided coin, rather. Mm-hmm. That'll work. On the one hand, the resiliency I learned from my father because, you know, as I've said many times, you know, I also feel uncomfortable not centering my mother in these conversations because our survival could not have occurred had it not been for her resourcefulness. But my father's sort of working through his own demons and his own screw-ups, right? He managed to sink a couple of jobs after the strike even. But his resilience was absolutely a model for me. But the other side of that is I have found in the past myself playing out this narrative in which I am living into some inevitable crisis that is going to be a turning point in my life. And all that produced was a series of unnecessary moments of self-sabotage. So while I was persevering, I had also been creating the problems through which I needed to persevere. Yeah, it's complicated, I'll say.
Growing up in South Jersey, you write that both you and your father would sort of extol the idea of, you know, the first black person to X or Y. And, you know, this was something you both aspired to for yourselves well into the 90s. But then you write that one of the more destructive ideas to be planted in the souls of black folks is that of the talented 10th, W.B. Du Bois's idea, the idea that some elite African Americans should be responsible for shattering racial stereotypes. Why do you see that as destructive now? You see it as elitist? What?
Well, first of all, it divides a population into a 10% and a 90%. And it says that the 10% is responsible for the improvement in life experience of the 90%. That puts a lot of pressure on anyone who is inclined to see themselves as part of that 90%. Second of all, it forces one to imagine that the community, however we conceive of that community, actually wants my, for example, leadership or needs my leadership. I think there's a kind of built-in condescension when we say, I am better than 90% of the people whom we identify in America as African American. Back to your point that you raise, the idea of being the first black person to do something, you have to first agree that black people are not part of the general population, that the achievements within this community are not consistent with the achievements of people throughout the rest of society.
Gregory, it seems poetry certainly gave you a big direction in life, and yet you don't talk about it that much in the book. Why is that?
I didn't want to go down the rabbit hole. I can be really geeky when I talk about poetry. And the language that I have for poetry is all steeped in kind of literary theory and as I say, really—
You'd have to get academic on me, is what you're saying.
I'd have to get all academic up in there.
Okay.
And I wanted to withhold that, you know, spare readers from my enthusiasm.
Fair enough. Alcoholism plays a big role in this. Your brother struggles with it. And then through that, you realize you have a drinking problem.
Well, I knew it long before my brother struggled with it, but yeah.
Well, I guess you confront your drinking problem.
I confront it, yeah.
You know, in a deeper way. I'm curious, mm-hmm. what do you think your dad would think of this work? He died before you were able to finish it.
I think he would be comfortable with the book, and I think he would find some way, in fact, even to be proud of the book. And I don't think he would disagree with my representation of us as a family.
Mm-hmm.
He would challenge me on it, certainly.
Sure.
I think that would be an interesting conversation.
Right.
But I don't think he would say anything was wrong.
Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Gregory Pardlow's new book is Air Traffic, a memoir of ambition and manhood in America. Gregory, it was a pleasure.
Oh, pleasure's mine. Thank you.